Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, just whenever I finish the book, I do the review and stick it up on the podcast feed. Which means I just finished a book yesterday called Accelerando by Charles Stross. But I'm actually at the moment working on a cruise ship and the room that I'm in, my cabin on the cruise ship, is right at the back of the ship above the propellers on the back of the ship, which means if you can hear this big rumbling noise in the background, that is just the sound of the ship in the background. Normally a lot of these cruise ships, I'm put up some cabin at the top of the ship out of the way and it's really quiet, but down at the back of this, it's quite an old ship as well, the way that it works is that a lot of the new cruise ships have this thing called pod propulsion, which means that the diesel generators generate electricity, and then there's these electric motors stuck down, like hung and slung underneath the bottom of the ship, and when they spin around it goes like this and it's really smooth and all the vibration is kept away from the ship. Whereas this ship that I'm in at the moment, from, I don't know, built in 1960s or 70s, the early 70s, this ship was built in. It's an old rattly ship that I'm going on at the moment. Anyway, so a little bit of news. Well, I'm putting more and more news up on my blog. So if you go to lukeburridge.com/blog, you can find news about what I'm up to there. Also, in my extended sort of push into Web 2.0, I've signed up for Twitter. And so while I have access to a computer, not for the last few days because I've been traveling and performing, so you can follow me on Twitter. And again, I'm not really sure why I'm doing this, but I thought, you know, I'd sort of join the craze, see if anyone actually cares what I'm doing. You know, in between that and my blog, you can pretty much keep up with any news that I'm up to. And also, one other thing that I'm trying to do to sort of like try out some different things, keep interesting, keep feedback coming from the listeners, in different ways, is that I was inspired by another podcast that I listened to do like a live recording of this podcast by Ustream. It's like a live video streaming website, and all you do is like sign up there. I mean, I'll post the link somewhere, and then you can watch me live record a podcast, do the review of the next book. The next book I'm going to be reviewing is Dan Simmons' Hyperion, which is a well known book. Probably lots of people have read it who are listening to this. So what you should do is come along and check out that. And then at the end of my review, I'm going to open it up for questions and other comments for other people who read the book to give comments, or I'll read them out of the comments from the chat room, because there's like a chat room built into the Ustream kind of thing there. Or just, you know, answer questions and things like that, and just stick that out at the end of the podcast. And the best way to actually keep this up, because I don't know when I'm going to finish the book, but it'll probably be within the next 4 or 5 days, is just check out the blog or check the feed of the sfbrp.com, you know, blog feed, podcast feed kind of thing. Either I'll announce it there, and also keep out an eye on Twitter as well, because I'll mention it on Twitter, say, hey, join me at this address in 2 hours time or 3 hours time and we'll do the recording. So that's the idea, that's the plan for the next podcast, not this podcast of course, because you've already missed this. I'm recording it at sea, but the next one with Dan Simmons' Hyperion review that I'm going to do, I'll do that as a live streaming thing if it sets up. If it doesn't work, don't worry about it, but I'm going to give it a go. So email me if you like the idea, or if you think the idea is really dumb and you think of a better way that I should do it. Finally, news. If anyone's keeping up with my life as a budding new novelist, I sent out edit number 5 of my first novel to 19 different people who requested to read that, and I'm awaiting feedback right now. I mean, I've not checked my emails for the last 3 days. It's feeling a bit weird to be disconnected from the world. I mean, it happens quite often. And so at the moment, I'm actually taking a bit of a break from writing and editing books and stuff, and just catching up on some reading. So on to today's book. Today's book is Charles Stross, Accelerando, and of course this is the place where I reach over to pick up the book that I normally review, and I pick up Dan Simmons' Hyperion, because I read this one as an e-book on my iPhone, on my iPod Touch, and so I don't actually even know the page count, but I do know, I looked it up, it was published in 2005. Last time I did this, I looked up on Wikipedia, but I don't have internet access here, and I can't be bothered to set up a shipboard account for internet access here. So I don't know how long the book is pages-wise, but, you know, it's probably a standard book. I don't know, actually. So, setting up the universe, the book covers quite a lot of ground, but it starts in the near future, and the whole idea behind the book, the whole sort of thesis, the whole premise, is that computers are continuously becoming more powerful, more ubiquitous, and better connected, and better connected to humans, and better connected to each other, and better connected to data generally. And so what happens in the book is it pretty much follows like a family through successive generations. And we find out that in the future, these like computing trends continue. You know, things get faster and faster all the time. And so, so what we have is like this future history of what's going to happen with computers and networking. And so, throughout the book, we Charles Strozzi sort of drops in these like passages, these short passages, saying that what percentage of the solar system is now made up of computers, and he calls this substance computronium, something like that. So it's sort of like matter that can compute and communicate its computational results to the world, or to the rest of the the computronium, and you know, and how much processing power is available. And of course, by the end of the book, the situation is pretty extreme, with pretty much most of the matter in the solar system, not all of it, but most of it near the sun, is being like, you know, it's all been consumed by clouds of computronium particles. And I'm not going to get into too much more details about this, because that's what the book's around. I don't really want to spoil it, but like I say, you know, the different various stages of the whole system accelerating and like pushing towards the singularity, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. However, reading about this kind of setup, it was both like really interesting in one part, and really frustrating in others. It was interesting because the vision of the future of the solar system is very well thought out, and it's like quite plausible, or it seems quite plausible. And at the end, you've got like often happens in these books, you've got like the cosmological idea, the amateur cosmological ideas that are going on there, and sort of like answers to the Fermi paradox and stuff, which, you know, these like modern writers always like to drop into their books near the end, and it's pretty fun. That kind of thing's pretty fun. Because Charles Strozzi does it very well. But it was very frustrating because they've got this continuous rush into the future, and like there's this point, and like it is the point of the whole book, but then as soon as we leave the point in the book that humans can relate to the computers at any level, like the whole kind of computronium kind of takeover, and all of like the massive network which is there to the humans that we can actually relate to, that we're actually following throughout the book, like it just becomes this generic threat, and it sort of loses any meaning, and you sort of lose your own connection to it. It's like this vague thing just happening in the background, and instead of being able to describe it in any ways that you can understand, Charles Strozzi sort of just relies on saying there's now 10 to the 34th power calculations per second, and I'm like, is that big? Is that small? I don't really know. And you're sort of having to find yourself flicking forward and back through the book, just working out which number is bigger, or how much bigger the number is than it was before. You know, how many steps up? You know, how many orders of magnitude greater it is. But then at that point, you're just like, okay, the number has increased. You know, the dial has spun further to the right, and that's really all I was getting out of it there. And that's what happens not just by the end of the book, you know, just even by halfway through, instead of being able to conjure up any sort of literary way of describing the, like the mind-numbing numbers involved in the calculations and the size of the computronium and what it is, it's just like Strauss just lists how much and how fast it's going. For example, at one point he goes, oh, and she did this, and in 3 minutes she used more bandwidth than the entire communications infrastructure of the entire Earth up to the year 2008. And I'm like, okay, that sounds like a lot, but I can't even get my head around that. I mean, I don't know how much bandwidth the world has used up until last year. You know, I mean, it was written a few years ago in 2005. So, of course, he's picking like a near future date there that we can relate to. But even then, I can't really relate to it. And it seems like the book relies a bit too much on just like listing high numbers and big things. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's just like the huge scope of the background story, you know, not the characters that we're following around, but the actual background, it sort of works against itself by becoming so big and so huge. And that's what the book is about, you know, that's what the book as a whole about, you know, but it's because it gets so huge, I can't relate to it on a human level. It just becomes a bland, things are getting faster, you know, and now they're even faster, and then the next chapter, now they're even faster. But that's just the setup. Let's get into the main story. It's broken into three parts, and each of the three parts is split into three chapters. We've got a book of nine chapters. We begin with a character called Manfred, and he's got a quite a strange and interesting job. He comes, his job is to come up with ideas for new products and new services and new inventions and new business models, and then he patents them really quickly at high speed, and then he gives them away to people. So in the morning he comes up with that ideas, and then he patents them, and then people he meets throughout the day, he gives these ideas away. He doesn't earn any money, he doesn't do any business himself, but what he does do is have the people and the companies that he's helped out, who he's helped become really rich in the past, they you know, they follow his ideas for him, and then with the money that they make, they look after him. So he doesn't have to pay for travel or staying in hotels or restaurants or anything like that. Everything just gets provided for him. He doesn't have to worry about anything, which is quite a cool life, and I thought it was really interesting. Unfortunately, we don't stick with his story. Like I say, we get like this future history. So he does this for the first one or two chapters in the book, and then so he sort of drops out of the picture for a while there. Which is a pity, because I could have really done with a whole novel just following Manfred there. Anyway, he's got a girlfriend, and she's also his like dominatrix. They've got this dom sub kind of partnership going on there. Her name is Pamela, and she's also a tax collector. Dum dum dum. So they have got this really bizarre relationship where she wants to have him as a lover, and also. She wants him to pay tax, like all these freebies that he gets. You know, she goes, "Oh, but you're a British citizen, so you should be paying tax and all of this." And she's going, "How do you think of this 15 million tax bill?" And he's like, "Oh, what?" But of course, he's quite a clever guy, so it's quite fun to like see him get out of this kind of thing. So, also in the first chapter, I'll just stick there for a bit, we get introduced to like this collective of uploaded, and I think the sort of uploaded accelerated lobster brain intelligences, and they want to escape from the human influence, and this idea is sort of introduced in this slightly too offhand manner, as though, you know, like me as a reader, I shouldn't really expect them to play a pivotal role later on in the book, and of course they do, and of course I'm like, yep, there it is. And it's the same kind of thing happens with this cat called, I wrote down the name here, Aneko. It's like the Sony robotic cat, which is continuously updated and upgraded. The body's upgraded and it gets fur, and then it gets better software and things like that. So the cat plays a part throughout the book as well. And there's other characters that we meet early on in the book in the first few chapters. We've got this Italian politician. He's quite an elderly guy, but he pops up throughout the book. And also we've got this French businesswoman called Annette. She works for, I think, the European Space Agency or something like that. And she becomes this rival love interest against Pamela for the affections of Manfred. And again, there's quite an interesting love triangle there at the beginning of the book. But again, these characters, they sort of get dropped, and then we follow other characters, because of course the story sort of plods along in this meandering path, you know, through the different generations of Manfred's offspring. You know, there's Manfred and Pamela, and a bit of Annetta as well at the beginning, and then their daughter, oh, this is Manfred's and Pamela's daughter, called Amber, and then there's a love interest in there, and they have a son as well, and his name is called, I think it's Sirhan or something like that. And finally, of course, he gets a lover, and then there's a son there as well. I can't remember all of the names of the different characters throughout the book, but you know, it goes through this thing in this kind of, like I say, this meandering way. And I say it's meandering because all these characters, they all have their own little adventures, because it's like almost a collection of short stories throughout the book, but their adventures seem to happen in a very like passive way. They're all quite passive characters. They seem to set something up, and then they'll like have an idea or something, you know, someone, and they'll give their idea to someone, or they'll do something, and then there'll be another agency or another character who'll actually do something with this idea. For example, at the beginning, like, Manfred has this idea and says, oh, we'll do this, and of course someone else goes off and uses it, and then he has this idea, political idea, and then someone else goes off and does that, and then, like, Amber goes on this adventure, but what she actually does at the end of it, she sort of fails, and, well, not really fails, but by the end of it, she doesn't really make anything of it, but there's other characters, or there's other agencies go off and make something of it. And it seems to happen time and time through the book, like this family, this you know, this multi-generation story. They constantly seem to strive for relevance in the world, but they constantly fail. And well, they don't really always fail, but it's like nothing they seem to do have a huge impact on the larger world. You know, there's a big thing near the end of the book where, you know, in one reading it could seem like the members of the family, oh, they've saved the day, but actually in a closer reading, or my reading of the book, it's like they come up with some ideas which then other people go forward and take, and then they save the day because these other people come back with better ideas than this family have had. And I don't know, it just seems this really, maybe I'm just not describing it very easily here, I'm not describing it right, because you know, they do have some sway over some events, but at the end of the book, I'm just wondering why I should really care about them over these other characters who seem to have done more throughout the book, these other, like, minor characters, but I don't know. I guess it comes down to the face of it, that in, like, in the face of some overwhelming power, like, there's this all this computronium going on, and there's lots of power going on there. Humans really don't have much. They don't have much sway in the solar system anymore. Unlike the last book that I reviewed called Ventus, and unlike the Verna Vinge books, which are also set in these massive singularity kind of advanced things where there's these gods floating around, or almost gods floating around. But the rules of the world, the rules of the galaxy, or the solar system, or whatever we're dealing with, are set up so that individuals do have power, and that what individuals do throughout the book really does make a big difference in the wider universe. But here, in this book, it seems like the characters are sort of like, they're doing is trying not to be overwhelmed by the overwhelming power that I just mentioned before. They're like treading water. Like, for at least two-thirds of the book, they're just treading water. And I don't really want to read a novel about characters just treading water and trying to survive. I want to read a book about them not like treading water, but like striking out for the shore, like they're going for it, or they're striking out in the other direction to save someone else who's drowning. Or, I guess, if a book's done right, I want to read a book about someone who treads water and is all slowly drowning, you know, and what they find underneath the water once they've drowned. I don't know, I'm just, you know, babbling here. But treading water, characters just treading water in the book, just isn't engaging in any way. And like I said before, the story is made up of some shorter stories, you know, like every, like I say, there's like these nine chapters throughout the book, and some of them are quite fun, because, like, for example, Amber goes off on this trip to a nearby, like, brown dwarf star to investigate, like, an alien radio signal, and that's quite a fun section as well. And there's a section, of course, near the beginning of the book where Manfred, he loses his super advanced personal organizer computer kind of thing, and when he loses it, he loses his connection to the world, and he loses part of his identity, and he forgets who he is or what he's meant to be doing. But the thief who stole the computer ends up following the instructions on this, like, personal organizing software, and in a way he sort of becomes Manfred, and he starts going along and doing what Manfred used to do, is like sharing his ideas and doing this kind of thing, and then he's really disappointed that he doesn't get paid for it, you know. It's quite a fun little story there at the beginning, but the ends of the chapters, each of the chapters sort of fades away a little bit, and then like at least out of like half of the nine chapters in the book, you know, I was just reading through them, not really caring one way or another how things turned out story wise in this way, which, you know, isn't very good. It's a bit disappointed. Okay, next note. Two more things that I found disappointing in a story. Okay, if a device pops up that can suddenly bring someone back to life, you know, even if you lose the body, you can suddenly just grab their memories from somewhere and bring them back to life. I kind of lose all interest in that person's story because there's just no tension. It's like, where is the drama in this situation? Why should I fear on behalf of any of the characters when any of the protagonists, you know, if they die, oh, I just bring them back again. They continue their story. Or why should I, like, you know, it can happen as well in some books that someone will beat the antagonist, you know, the protagonist beats the antagonist, and it's like, yes, we got their way. And it's just like, oh, let's just bring back this baddie from the past. Oh, and this baddie, we'll bring them back as well. And it's sort of like reoccurring antagonist throughout the book. And it's just like, oh, I can't be bothered, because if you're going to defeat someone and then just brought back again, I don't know, no tension, and also uninspired plotting. It's like, oh, the story's dragging on again. Oh, let's bring this character back. You remember this character? Oh, that's really fun. And the second thing that I found disappointing is that, of course, the last chapter revelations that add nothing to the story. I made a note here about Singularity Sky, the other book by Charles Stross that I reviewed. In the last chapter, there's sort of like two or three or four, I can't remember, like twists at the end where we find out exactly who's working for who and who was pulling the strings throughout the rest of the book. And I think I mentioned in that review where I say, oh, and there's these minor characters who are a bit too fleshed out for them to be minor characters. And of course, they turn out not to be minor characters, but yet they didn't add anything throughout the book. And the good, like a good twist at the end of a book, I love a good twist at the end of a book, especially if they're satisfying. It's like, oh, that makes sense. Oh, and now that makes sense. And this makes sense. Oh, and of course, because that person was working for that person. Oh, now I understand it. It all makes sense. But then again, a twist that adds nothing to the book, which is in the case of both Singularity Sky and this book, Accelerando. Like, the story could have functioned perfectly well without the big revelation at the end. And that's the case in both of these books. You know, you're going on and there's not really anything going on at the end of these stories. You know, for example, in Singularity Sky, Like, it's got this interesting setup where there's a universe where time travel is illegal, it's forbidden. So, but then we follow this starship who's trying to sort of bend the rules slightly and travel back in time, and you're like, woohoo, time travel. I love time travel. You know, it's one of my favourite science fiction devices. But then, of course, at the end it works out that they don't manage to travel back in time, and then the spaceship, when it turns up there, it fails to do what it's meant to do when it turns up there, and this guy, and then at the end, this guy worked for someone else, and that guy worked for this person. And then... In fact, I can't even remember what does actually happen at the end of it, but by the end of the book, it's sort of like my interest has just trailed off, and like the promise of any story at all, or any big kind of payoff at the book, just never fulfilled. And it's the same with this book. So reading the end of the last chapter, in fact, pretty much the last two chapters, I'm just going, oh, okay. And the second to last chapter, I'm like, oh, okay, they're actually doing something here. They're actually getting somewhere here. And then at the end of the last chapter, I was like, oh, that was a convenient twist, but at the same time, a very pointless twist. It's like, why did the character do that? And... yeah, I don't know. It's not a twist. It's like a twist in inverted commas. It's like, now check this out. And it's like, yeah. But if the story wasn't any good throughout it, just adding that this person worked for that person at the end doesn't make it a better story. It doesn't make it any more enjoyable to reading through the story if it's not needed. It's like a punchline at the end of the joke, but you didn't realise there was a joke. You know, you thought it was just a normal story. And then suddenly there's a punchline, you realise that it's a disappointing joke, which isn't funny, and it makes the whole rest of the... you know, unimpressive stories sort of like fall apart as well. And I think actually I mentioned again in the Singularity Sky book that it's like this whole sort of bad sort of like slightly tedious story going through is like the opposite of a page turner. We didn't really care about any of the characters. And it's the same in this book again. It's like the opposite of a page turner. I guess enough about the story. And the characters, again, it's the same kind of thing as in Singularity Sky. Like, there are some characters, and they sort of change over time, and they disappear, and they reappear, and they sort of copy themselves in this book. But, again, it's when the characters ultimately, like, fail to keep up my interest towards the end of the book, or even... well, from the first characters in the book, I really enjoyed, but then as it goes through, it's like... I know at the end of each chapter, we're going to skip forward another 10 years into the future. And, like, any investment that I had in their situation at the time, I know that it's because it's going to skip forward at the end of the chapter. All I need to do is push through to the end of the chapter, and I'll get somewhere new. And it didn't really feel like anything was paying off as I got there, which is a real pity. The technology, though, in the book, lots of really good stuff. I really like widgets and gadgets and lots of different stuff, and I like things being taken to the extreme, you know, like a technological idea taken to the like to the ultimate conclusion. And I think Charles Stross does that really, really well. And I almost don't want to talk about it too much because it's the most interesting thing that I found in this book. I don't want to spoil the things, but I guess some things, like, for example, the whole like interstellar spaceship kind of trip that they go on is really cool, and also paving Saturn, I'll just leave it at that, also a really cool idea part of the way through the book. And this really cool sort of like, I think it's called a particle fog or particle mist or whatever it is called, and there's the idea is that there's lots of microscopic invisible particles sort of floating around everywhere, and at a command they sort of inflate and stick to each other, to the other, like, to the other particles around them and to the floor and things, which means that you can literally go, I want a chair, and all these micro particles expand and, you know, conjure up a chair out of thin air. Well, not out of thin air, there's stuff in the air, but it's so small you can't see it until it inflates. And that's pretty cool. And I like the ideas of implanting consciousness into other ideas, like consciousness into other animals, that's what I'm trying to say, because they do that, and implanting a consciousness into a flock of birds sounds pretty cool. I quite like that idea. And also, there's all lots of other, like, not just technological inventions in the book, but, like, cultural and economic inventions. Like, for example, if you want to, like, disown your parents, how about becoming a slave, but owning yourself? And that's always cool. And then the way that the parents can then reassert control over their offspring is equally fun and interesting as well there. So that's what this book really shines in. But I guess just technological ideas doesn't a good story make, which is a real pity because, you know, that's really what I want from a book. You know, it can't just be the science part of the science fiction. You need the fiction kind of stuff going in there as well, the actual story as well. A bit about the writing style. I don't normally touch too much on the writing style of books, but this book really annoyed me because it's all written in the present tense. Now, when this is done well, it can be really effective at making a story feel very immediate. For example, there's the book Snow Crash, which I pretty much panned like everything in this book. But I don't think at the time in that review I actually mentioned that it's all written in the present tense. It was actually quite confusing early on. I didn't mention it because early on in the book it was a negative point, because there's these different timelines. Like, one thing's happening now, but one thing was happening 2 weeks in the past, but we're being told them both sort of like in alternative sections of the book, but they're both in present tense, and it's very confusing there. The whole timeline at the beginning of the book is quite confused. But after that first passage, everything it's like a continuous story. Everything's happening, one thing happens, and the next thing happens, the next thing happens, and the next thing happens. And because it's written in present tense, it makes it very immediate. And then after like the first three chapters, you just don't notice. It just flows, and you're just in present tense, and it doesn't even matter at all anymore. But in Accelerando, because we've got this continuous jumping forward in time, and jumping forward in time, and jumping forward in time, and going into different places, and going into different modes of thought, and talking about lots of different things, but that is all told in the present tense, even though it's told over a long period of time, it just sort of kept pulling me out of the story, kept jerking me out of the story. And I'm not really sure why, because it... Well, I think that's probably why, because it's told over so much time. I just don't understand why it was done. At one point, though, the reason for Charles Stross using present tense is explained by one character. He's actually writing a history of his family, and he says that progress is happening so quickly that history and fiction is going to be really difficult to write, because anyone who's experiencing it, any kind of future reader, is everything is going to be so immediate and everything is going to be happening so fast that everything will feel like it's happening in the present tense or something like that. So he's writing the book from the point of view of present tense, and also from the point of view of the family cat, this mechanical cat, robot cat that I talked about earlier. But the thing is, then I'm thinking, okay, but is this what I'm reading now? Is the book Accelerando, is that the history that he is writing? And I'm thinking, it can't be, because if he was just writing the history in the present tense, he wouldn't have included all these like inconsequential bits which would only make sense to people who are reading it in 2005 to 2009. You know, all the references that he's writing, oh, like, this is happening there and this is happening at the same speed as the internet would have, like, everyone on the internet talking to each other at the same time would have happened in a second, you know, at this point, and more storage than the entire internet up to the year 2006. And all those kind of, like, comments that he puts in, he wouldn't put in for future people reading, like, future intelligences reading his story. So it's obviously written for people in the past. In other words, it's obviously written by Charles Stross, not this person who he's mentioning in the book. This whole meta kind of fiction going on there of people in the book talking about their own fiction that they're writing. So in the end, it feels more like an excuse at that point. You know, when I actually read that he's writing it in the first person, it's sort of like, well, that's not... Is it clever or is it an excuse? I don't really understand why it was done overall. Another thing about the writing style is all the references to other science fiction creations. For example, the book is obviously influenced quite a lot by Verne Vinge, and so Stross not just slightly references his fiction, he name drops Verne Vinge throughout the book, like two or three times. I know he's like just mentioned blatantly there. Also, a lot of things happen in virtual reality. And I think at two distinct points in the book, I think it's 2 points, a character said, "I need guns, lots of guns," which is like directly quoting Neo from The Matrix, Keanu Reeves there. And it's not only that, but when one of the other characters that he says it to doesn't react, like the first character actually said, "I need guns, lots of guns," it's like, don't you get like the reference that I just made? Like, The Matrix is this huge like cultural thing that's happened in the past there. And it's sort of like I'm being winked at by Charles Stross. It's like, hey, you might recognize this idea from the works of Verne Vinge. You might recognize this idea from the works of this person. You might recognize this idea from the works. But it's like, okay, referencing those people, it's like he's constantly winking at me. And I find myself frustrated because it's like, I don't mind if an author is winking at me and isn't taking his own creation seriously. But this is meant to be, as far as I can tell, this is meant to be a serious novel. And I want Charles Stross to actually take his own ideas a bit more seriously throughout it. Otherwise, I just find myself a bit frustrated by this. And also, finally, back to referencing Verne Vinge and also Joan D. Vinge as well, who I've also reviewed. I think back in episode number 2, the first book review that I did here, I mentioned this as something I don't like in books, and that is using seconds as the main time unit in your book. Because you've got, like, seconds, and then kiloseconds, and megaseconds, and gigaseconds, and teraseconds. And, again, I don't really want to get into this, because I think I've mentioned this in other book reviews that I do. It's like, Everything else in the book is translated into English, into modern English. It's written to people who live now in this decade. So everything's in English and everything's talking about things that we can associate with and we can reference and we live with now. Like even a language is that super advanced alien civilizations and intelligences are using to talk to each other is translated into English for me now as the reader to understand. So it's like, why can't you just say, this happened and I'm 45 years old, or this happened 45 years later, or something like that, rather than saying 1.5 gigaseconds. Because I'm like, oh, okay, let me look it up now. What's a gigasecond? And in the front of Verna Vinge's books, and in Joan D. Vinge's books as well, they actually put a little reference there on how long a gigasecond would be, and you could look it up. But of course, this isn't. There's no guide in this, because it's like an e-book that I'm reading, maybe in the paper book, there's that. So then I had to get out a calculator and work out exactly how much 1.5 gigaseconds would be. I mean, I read it on my iPod Touch, and there's a calculator right there. You know, I had one right there with me, but it's still sort of, Charles Stross is intentionally making it difficult for me as the reader to understand. And the only reason I can make think that he's doing this is because it makes it feel more sci-fi-ish. You know, it's sort of like, hey, this is a cool sci-fi thing. But, like, you're talking about someone living in a computer simulation and he comes from Mars, you know, just off the top of my head. It's like, it's science fiction. I know it's science fiction. You don't need to throw in this whole gigaseconds and teraseconds kind of thing to make me know that it's science fiction. I've got it. Just say, in 3 months, in 20 minutes, in this many years, and don't convert it into seconds just for me to get a calculator out and then convert it back into minutes and hours and days and years for me to work it out again. Anyway, really, really, really annoys me. Finally, normally I talk about themes at the end of a review and what you talk about there and what the author's going for and aiming for and like trying to bring up in my mind and stuff. But again, I think I did the same kind of thing in Singularity Sky. It's like, at the end of this book, it's like, I don't care. I mean, really what he's talking about is future technology and future computing and future trends there. And those themes that he teases out are really, really good. Like the ultimate, like what he goes on about in the last few chapters where he explains, you know, like I said before about the Fermi paradox and how all of this can work out towards those aims and what it'd be like to live there. Yeah, sure, I understand all of that, but what the characters are actually going through and what the characters are thinking, you know, there's bits and pieces about religion and I just don't care about it. There's things about families and revenge and love and stuff. I just don't really care about what the characters have to say about that. And because I don't care about the characters, I feel it really hard to be engaged with what Charles Stross is trying to tell me about these kind of things. I mean, there's obviously a lot of things that he wants to touch on, but because it's this, like, weird kind of flippancy to the writing at some points and then, like, me being disengaged by the characters at other points, I just don't really get it. So I don't really feel like I was engaged enough to actually care about the themes enough to talk about them here, which is a real pity, because I'm sure there could have been some stuff in there. So, to conclude the end of this review, Charles Stross is the best guy. He's the go-to guy for cool ideas. He's the master of technobabble. He can technobabble at a higher level than pretty much any other science fiction writer out there at the moment. But really, I think he could really benefit by working in collaboration with another author, someone who actually has a good story idea. So get someone who's really good at story, get Charles Stross, who's really good at the technobabble and all the like big ideas that he comes up with, and then like get them to work together, because just setting out what might happen in the future isn't good enough. You've got to have characters that me, as a reader, that I care about, and they've got to do things that matter, and they have to do things that impact the world. And at the end of the book, an ending isn't just an inconsequential secret that you reveal there, which doesn't have any impact on the rest of the story. An ending of a book is where the... I don't know what an ending of a book is. I guess it's where, like, a character passes a point where they're, like, they've changed in some way, that they can't go back, you know, that the options that they had, like, two-thirds of the way through the book are now reduced by half. They've taken one of the options, and they're left with one place that they've got to go down, and they've got to follow this path, and they can't go back. That's what the ending means. It's like something happens, this critical thing happens, and there's some kind of resolution. Of course, I'm probably not making any more sense now at all than I am at the beginning. Let me just say this. At the end of a book, you can't just fade out. Music can fade out. Novels can't fade out. And there was somewhere around about chapter 7, like part 3, chapter 1, where something happens and it's built to. And then the last two chapters, like the second last chapter, one more thing happens. And then the last chapter, nothing happens. There's just this little resolution, this little revelation kind of thing. Not even a resolution. The last two chapters could literally have been reduced down to about 10 pages. And they didn't need to happen years and years later. You could have just had like a little, like a 10-page prologue at the end of the book, because everything else was set up there, and you could have just gone over the same plot points and provide the same level of resolution that you could have done in the last two chapters. So it just sort of dragged on out there. I really do think this is what Charles Stross should do. He should write the world, because there's lots of world building here, which is fantastic. Lots of good technology, lots of good points. He should have written out all of the different ideas, had Manfred maybe there as an idea, you know, this guy who makes up different inventions, you know, either just follow his story or just, like, you know what I'm saying, just set out the whole world and then have someone else come in and create a story that goes through this world with characters that I care about and characters that you can care about and characters that are effectual in some way, you know, have some effect and are affected, whichever one it is, by the rest of the world a little bit more there. I think that's where he needs to do a bit more. So, like Singularity Sky, I'm going to also give this book 2.5 stars because it's underwhelmingly average, or maybe overwhelmingly average. Lots of good stuff. Lots of technology. Really love all the gadgets, all of the widgets, everything going on is great, except severely hamstrung by a lack of any kind of engagement with me as a reader on top of just cool gadgets, no characters, very, very little storyline, no resolution, a bit fading out at the end there. So, actually, that same conclusion I've just given pretty much fit for both Accelerando and Singularity Sky, I think. So just keep that in mind if you want. If you're going to go back and listen to the review that I did of Singularity Sky, you might hear some of the same points reiterated there. So that's it, 2.5 stars. Next book that I'm going to do, that I'm going to review, is Hyperion by Stan Simmons. I've been saying this for like the last month that I'm going to read this book, but because I've been doing everything just off my iPod and reading some free books and getting into some Creative Commons kind of books there, sort of put this book aside, and because I didn't take it with me on my last trip. But here, I started reading it yesterday, and I'm really getting into it because I sort of read the prologue and a bit into the first chapter before, and sort of, I guess I was just a bit tired at the time, a bit jet lagged or something at the time, so I couldn't really get into it. But now I'm really getting into it, really enjoying it so far. So that's about it. I'll do that next time, maybe as a live video streaming thing where you can throw out comments and questions if you've read the book and disagree with my take on Hyperion or anything like that. So email me, luke@juggler.net, or see my blog for more info and more of my sort of general news about me reading and writing and my travels and my juggling and videos and photography and anything you want to do there. I just put all that stuff on my blog now. And also follow me on Twitter for daily updates on the same kind of thing as my blog, but shorter. And any news on future video streamings or recordings of next shows or anything like that. So I put that up on Twitter. Maybe, I don't know. Don't know how long I'm going to stick with Twitter, but I'll try it out for a few months. I know that. That's about it for now, so I'll catch you next time.